Hi everyone. Any questions before I start? So I want to just make like one or two more quick comments on MCMCs. So we talked about the importance of matching the covariance matrix of the proposal density if we're doing Metropolis sampling with a Gaussian proposal density. Matching that to the Hessian matrix of the log likelihood function, like you might take this to be a multiple of the second derivative. You might compute the inverse Hessian matrix at the point of maximum likelihood and take the proposal density to be a multiple of it, where the multiplier is tuned to give a 30% acceptance rate. Or if you've computed the Fisher matrix, you might just do this instead. A likelihood function where you might have trouble is one where, imagine you have a likelihood function where the one sigma region is very non-Gaussian and there's some, you know, complicated nonlinear contour. Then the MCMC is supposed to be sampling all over this region. But if I choose a proposal density whose Hessian matrix is matched here, then the Hessian matrix over here will be a fairly different matrix. And it'll be hard to find a proposal density that works everywhere along the degenerate region. But if the likelihood function is sort of a tame blob, like in the example I had in the slides, you know, there was something that was pretty non-Gaussian, but it was just a big blob. No funny-looking nonlinear degeneracies like this, then this should work. This Metropolis Gaussian proposal density will probably work fine. The Hessian might actually be kind of different out here in the tails of the likelihood compared to the peak, but the difference will probably just be some order one difference, not a big qualitative difference, and the chain won't spend much time out here anyway. The ultimate nightmare scenario for an MCMC sampler is the case of a multimodal likelihood. You have some likelihood like this. Then what might happen is that your chain or chains all end up in one peak. And you can run the chains for 10 to the 6 samples, 10 to the 7 samples. And if this is, you know, a very deep well that's difficult to tunnel through, then everything will appear to converge, but you're just missing part of the likelihood function, and your final answers can be wrong by order one. There are special techniques, if we want to go outside the Metropolis Hastings toolkit, that are designed to deal with multimodal likelihoods. But you can always construct like malicious examples where there's some big piece of the likelihood function that contributes, you know, a lot to the likelihood integral. But it's hard to find in the sense that it's confined to a very small volume and parameter space. And there's really no surefire technique, no like bulletproof MCMC sampler that will work well for all likelihoods. It's always possible for any sampling algorithm to find an example of likelihood where the algorithm will work badly. I want to say that the role of MCMCs in statistics is kind of loosely analogous to the role of differential equations in physics, where they're ubiquitous. Many problems can be formulated using them. But just as in physics, if you can formulate, lots of problems can be formulated as solving a differential equation, but the differential equation may be anywhere from easy to impossible. And the same is true for MCMCs. The last topic I want to talk about is, since I have one more lecture, is I want to talk about how you would analyze multiple fields and non-scalar fields. The main example I want to talk about is CMB polarization, which is a non-scalar quantity. But I'll talk generally about multiple fields and non-scalar fields. Actually, the part that I want to do on the blackboard is just talk about the details of how you represent the two-point function. So for a single scalar field, usually represent the two-point function with the power spectrum rather than the correlation function. And just to review the logic here, the translation invariance in real space shows up in Fourier space as this delta function on the right-hand side. And then the rotation invariance means that the coefficient of the function, the prefactor in front of the delta function, only depends on the length of the vector L. If I were assuming translation invariance but not rotation invariance, then this would be a vector L. So the next step in complexity would be the two-point correlation function of n scalar fields. And by the same logic, the correlation function between, in Fourier space, between Fourier modes of field I and field J would have this delta function on the right-hand side. And the coefficient only depends on the length of the vector L by rotation invariance, but it can be different for each I and J. So in this case, the power spectrum is a matrix. The matrix Cij is symmetric, positive, definite, and real. I won't write out the proof of these statements, but they're actually really straightforward and mechanical to prove. You may even be able to stare at the definition and see why these statements are true. Positive semi-definite. You can have a zero eigenvalue. Just remember that phi star is equal to phi of a negative L, and the proofs are straightforward. So if, for example, you wanted to, if you were handed this matrix-valued power spectrum, and you wanted to simulate a realization of the n-component random field, then that simulation procedure might go like this. Previously, we showed that if I order all the Fourier modes in the simulation volume, that the covariance matrix is diagonal in Fourier space. More precisely, if I take the Fourier modes in the simulation volume and put their real and imaginary parts into a covariance matrix, this is the real and imaginary part of phi L1, phi L2, and so on. In the case of a single scalar field, that matrix is completely diagonal. And now in the case of n scalar fields, I can still draw the same picture, but now each of the entries here, like the real part of phi at the first Fourier mode L1, it now has an I index. And so this now corresponds to, in the picture, to n rows of the covariance matrix. And the covariance matrix is block diagonal. So if I order the real degrees of freedom that I want to simulate by taking the the real parts of the n Fourier modes at wave number L, then the n imaginary parts, and so on, then the covariance matrix will be block diagonal, where each of these blocks, CLIJ, is an n by n matrix. So if you have this block diagonal covariance matrix and you want to make a simulation, what you would do is just simulate a multivariate, an n-dimensional multivariate random Gaussian with the appropriate covariance matrix. And that could be done by either as we discussed before, either diagonalizing the covariance matrix in each block or Cholesky decomposing it. Since the covariance matrix can be different for each value of L, you would need to do that operation, either diagonalizing or Cholesky decomposing, independently for each Fourier mode. So that's the case of N scalar fields. I want to think about non-scalar fields next, including CMB polarization, which is described covariantly as a traceless symmetric two-index tensor. But to warm up, let me think about the case of a vector field, which is a little more intuitive. So if I have a single vector field, oh, I forgot to say everything is going to, I'm going to do everything in flat sky until the very end when I'll talk about the spherical generalization. So if I want to think about the two-point correlation function of a vector field, then what I would say is the obvious approach, which is not actually the best approach, would be to first go to Fourier space. And let me call the x and y components of the vector field capital X and capital Y. And then I could try to figure out what the symmetry constraints are on the two-point function. I could write the correlation function of so if I write the Fourier space two-point function between component I of the vector field and component J of the vector field, it's a 2x2 matrix with the I index here and the J index here. Then, there is by translation invariance, there's still this delta function on the right-hand side, but the rotation invariance now becomes more complicated. So what happens under a rotation is that if I apply a rotation of the coordinate system, then the x and y components of the vector field will mix with each other under that rotation. And that means that unlike the case of n scalar fields where, you know, a rotation just rotates each of the scalars independently. So that means that it's not true that if I were to parameterize the two-point function this way, it's not true that the autocorrelation of the XX autocorrelation, say, only depends on the length of L. Instead, there would be some rule that I need to work out. And you could pursue this approach and work it out. For how CLXX, CLXY, and CLYY rotate into each other under rotations, so that rotation invariance does impose a constraint on these coefficients and relates them all to each other, but in a way that's sort of non-trivial to work out. So I just we could pursue that and work out formulas for how rotation invariance constrains these spectra. I just wanted to sort of start in order to contrast it with a not so obvious and better approach. Which is to represent the Fourier space field this way. Instead of an x component and a y component, I'll write it as a component that points in the L hat direction. L hat is a unit vector pointing in the direction of L. Times times a piece which is perpendicular to L hat. If I contract L hat with the antisymmetric tensor epsilon ij, then I get L hat rotated by 90 degrees. You can also think of this as instead of describing the field in Fourier space by a pair of complex numbers, x of L and y of L, then I'll describe the field by a pair of complex numbers, g and c, which are related to x and y by this. This rotation. Phi L is the angle between L and the x-axis. Or, in other words, L is and the point of this decomposition is that G and C do not mix under rotations. If I have a field which is all G, for example, and I apply a coordinate transformation, then I'll get another. That just means every Fourier mode of the field, if you imagine drawing the Fourier transform of the field as a vector field in L space. If the field were all G, then all the arrows would be radial, and that property is preserved by rotation. That's sort of a proof by picture. Of course, you can do the formal calculation to work out. We know how the vector field, starting from the transformation law of the for a vector field in real space, you can work out the transformation law for its Fourier space representation and then for G and C. And you'll see that the transformation law does not mix G and C. That would be a good homework problem if I were assigning homework on this. Therefore, if I were to work out the write down the two-point function in the GC basis due to this non-mixing property, I would get three power spectra, just like there were three power spectra in the case of n scalar fields with n equals 2. The power spectrum is represented by a 2x2 symmetric matrix. And in the GC basis, the case of a vector field is no more complicated than the case of two scalar fields. There are just these three power spectra, GG, GC, and CC, that describe the two-point function. And as the notation, I didn't put the arrow here, so as the notation suggests, these power spectra only depend on. So in the right basis, the vector field is no more complicated than the case of two scalar fields. Now, if you needed to know going back to this initial approach, if you needed to know the two-point correlation function in the xy basis, you could work it out. If I start with this parameterization of the two-point function in the GC basis, and then this equation relating x and y to G and C, then it's straightforward to put those together and get an expression like this. And this is what we would have ended up with if we had kept pursuing the first approach long enough. You'd find that, indeed, the two-point correlation function of two x's does not just depend on the length of L. It has this particular dependence on phi L. So the rotation symmetry imposes this form of the phi L dependence and also relates the xx, xy, and yy correlation functions to each other in the sense that the same gg, gc, and cc power spectra appear in all of them. But I think in calculations, it's almost always a bad calculational strategy to involve expressions like this. It's usually best to think of the Fourier transform of a vector field. In real space, it's you think of the vector field as an object with x and y components. But when you go to Fourier space, say x of x, y of y, when I take the Fourier transform of a vector field, I claim that it's usually better to think of the Fourier transform as including the phi L dependent rotation that goes to the GC basis, so that the Fourier space representation of a field is this this guy on the right, and its real space representation is this guy on the left. Think of the rotation as being part of the Fourier transform. Okay. So there's one symmetry that we haven't talked about yet, and that's parity invariance. This form of the two-point function follows from translation and rotation invariance alone. And indeed, for scalar quantities, like the case of n-scalar fields, it turns out that parity invariance does not impose any additional constraint on the two-point function. But for fields with indices, it usually does. And in the case of a vector field, the parity invariance implies that the GC power spectrum is equal to zero. And so to give a proof of this, it suffices to consider a single Fourier mode. Let me write down. You know, when I stand here, I can't actually see what's on this blackboard because of the glare. So I have to, just for my own reference, I'm sure you guys can see it, but I have to write it down again. Okay, so to explain why this is true, it suffices to consider what happens at a single Fourier mode L, since the correlation function only allows an L to correlate with itself. And then if I'm thinking about a single Fourier mode L with components G of L and C of L, then you can see that if I now were to apply the parity reversing transformation, which reflects the plane through this fixing this this vector L, then that would preserve L hat. And so it would send G to itself. But it would send C to minus C. Because the parity reversing, under the parity reversing transformation, this epsilon symbol picks up the minus sign. And so that means that, generally speaking, one way to say it is that if I had a field that was not, whose statistics were not parity invariant, then if I were to apply a parity transformation to the field, it would leave CLGG and CLCC unchanged. But it would flip the sign of CLGC. So in the parity invariant case, where this is supposed to be, these two are supposed to be equal, that implies that CLGC is equal to zero. So this base, if parity invariance is assumed, as we almost always do in cosmology, the only exception is parity invariance holds in the standard cosmological model. The only situations where it doesn't is in exotic extensions where you have some pseudoscalar field around with an expectation value like an axion or primordial magnetic fields or something. So if parity invariance is assumed, then this GC basis is really convenient because the covariance matrix of the modes is fully diagonal. And so there's no diagonalization or Cholesky decomposition step involved if you have to simulate the field, for example, or if you write, or if you wanted to write down a likelihood function for Fisher forecasting or MCMC, there would be no matrix inverses in the likelihood function. You can loosely think of. Well, let me postpone that comment until I make this comment, which is that in real space, the GC decomposition is the gradient curl decomposition of a vector field, as the notation was implies. In real space, I can take a vector field in two dimensions and write it as the gradient of some scalar function, little g. Plus the 2D curl operator in two dimensions, the curl is an operator that operates on a scalar field. Well, actually, a pseudoscalar. The C here is a pseudoscalar. The curl is an operator that acts on a scalar field and just consists of taking the gradient and then rotating each of those vectors pointwise by 90 degrees. C here should be a pseudoscalar since if I want V to have the usual transformation law under parity reversing operations, then this G is a scalar, but this C has to be a pseudoscalar. It has to have an extra minus sign because the epsilon will acquire a minus sign when the parity is reversed. So this is another way of seeing, you could think of the G modes for a vector field as being scalar, sourced by a scalar, and the C modes as being sourced by a pseudoscalar. And so that's a nice sort of one sentence reason for why they can't correlate if parity invariance applies. Okay. So now I want to talk about CMB polarization, which is similar, but there's two indices instead of one. So first off, the CMB is linearly polarized. I guess I should say why that's true. So when I when a free electron scatters radiation, at least in the low in the limit where the photon energy is much lower than the rest mass of the electron, the Thompson scattering limit. And if you write down that Thompson cross scattering, then the radiation that the outgoing radiation from the electron will have linear polarization, which is proportional to the quadrupole moments of the temperature that the electron sees in its rest frame. So in cartoons, you know, if I'm looking down on an electron from above, and I have make the picture like this. If the electron is a cartoon for thinking about it is that this electron is radiating out of the board, and this electron is sitting in a temperature anisotropy where the temperature is higher in these directions than in this direction, then that incoming radiation will shake the electron more along this axis than along this axis. And so the linear polarization in this example would be vertical. That's the cartoon picture. In the CMB, polarization is generated, if this is us observing the CMB, and this is the redshift 1100 surface of last scattering, then the CMB polarization is generated, well, first, in a very narrow window of time, right at the end of recombination. So recombination, or the universe turning transparent so that CMB photons can propagate, is actually kind of an extended process where, as the temperature of the universe decreases, the neutral state of hydrogen becomes favored over the thermodynamically favored over the ionized state. And at very early times, the CMB plasma is a tightly coupled plasma, and there are no quadrupoles. At late times, there are no free electrons. Quadrupoles appear, like our CMB quadrupole today is non-zero. But there are no free electrons around to scatter them. And so if reionization were an instantaneous process, there would be no linear polarization coming from the last scattering surface. But we do get a little bit of linear polarization from the window of time where plasma is optically thin enough that photons have a time to free stream and develop quadrupoles. And there are still enough free electrons around to re-radiate them into linear polarization. So that's sort of a cartoon picture of the physics that produces the CMB is mostly unpolarized, but has a small amount of linear polarization. Linear, because the polarization of the CMB is small, polarization is more challenging to measure than CMB temperature anisotropy. So some of the linear polarization is coming from the very tail end of the last scattering surface. And on very large angular scales, CMB polarization is also coming from the post-reionization universe, redshifts below 6 or so. At these late times, the CMB quadrupole has become significantly non-zero. And at these late times, the universe reionizes free electrons appear again. And they can, Thompson scatter and produce more linear polarization.
Sorry. Could you just explain again about the Thompson scattering? I think something along the line here about the quadrupole.
Oh, yeah, so for linear polarization to arise by Thompson scattering, two conditions have to be satisfied. First, there have to be free electrons around. All the hydrogen can't be neutral. And second, if you imagine each free electron being like a little CMB telescope that can observe its CMB temperature and such, then the electron has to see a non-zero quadrupole. Now, that's not the case at very early times when the universe is a tightly coupled plasma. In a tightly coupled plasma, the plasma is a perfect fluid, meaning that the only degrees of freedom are like a temperature, which is a scalar, and a velocity, which is a dipole. And there are no quadrupole-like degrees of freedom, including the CMB. To show this formally would take a lecture or so. I'm just going to give you like the cartoon version. But it's useful to remember that these are sort of the two places where the CMB polarization, the linear CMB polarization is coming from, the post-reionization universe well after the rest of the CMB is formed, and like the very innermost edge of the last scattering.
But how does the quadrupole arise then in between the early universe and
red? By free streaming of CMB photons. So if you imagine that I start with a tightly coupled plasma, and then I turn off all of the interactions so that the photons are disallowed to free stream, then I see, like the reason that we see a CMB quadrupole today is because we're no longer living in a tightly coupled plasma. We can look out to this large this last scattering surface that's a long way away. And different parts of that last scattering surface have a different temperature. And so that produces anisotropy at not only the quadrupole, but very large values of them as well. If you, in other words, if you were to imagine doing a CMB experiment at redshift 10,006, then a local observer who could sit in this plasma and measure the CMB would only observe a CMB monopole and a CMB dipole, and they would observe no anisotropy above L equals 1. And after the universe starts to become optically thin and photons can free stream, the higher Ls start to build up. Okay. So just, if I have time to show slides, which I may actually not, then I'll try to elaborate on this a little bit more. But I just wanted to give some sort of like picture for why the CMB would be linearly polarized. So before I talk about the physics much, I want to talk about just the actual math for representing CMB polarization and its power spectrum. So here's a statement that I don't think is obvious at all. That linear polarization is described covariantly. As the traceless symmetric tensor. So when we draw a picture like this, showing the CMB linear polarization in different parts of the sky, this is really a visual representation of a traceless symmetric tensor. And particularly on the sphere, where there's like no natural coordinate system for the whole sphere, and you want to translate between different patches using the transformation law from GR, using transformation laws for tensors, then it's really helpful to have the statement in mind that the way that you would carry out those coordinate transformations is by applying the usual GR transformation law to a traceless symmetric tensor. So one way of seeing that is that one way to think about the intensity, including its polarized part, is to write down this 2x2 Stokes matrix. So there's a so in E&M books, you know, the way polarization is usually defined is that you have this 2x2 matrix, which you would form by, if I'm an observer measuring the electric field in a particular sky location, then once the sky location is fixed, then the electric field is a time series, which in Fourier space would be, after Fourier transforming, would be a complex function of frequency. Since the electric field is a vector quantity, it has an index I, which is tangent along the line of sight, tangent to the sphere. And if I average if I take expectation values of the form E of omega star E of omega over some band of omegas, then there are two indices here which describe a 2x2 Hermitian matrix. And that's the intensity tensor of the radiation that includes the temperature What do you call the I, T? So it looks more like the C and D case. The intensity tensor of the radiation would include the temperature. By definition, that's the trace. The circular polarization, that's the imaginary part of this 2x2 Hermitian matrix. And then the linear polarization is what's left over. It's a real traceless symmetric matrix. This way of describing it is just intended to make things a little more covariant and make it sort of manifest that on the sphere, where every line of sight is a point on the sphere, then the linear polarization would be, well, this intensity tensor would be defined everywhere. It would be a Hermitian two-index tensor defined at every point. And the linear polarization is just a piece of that, which is symmetric and traceless. Now on the flat sky or in a local coordinate system on the sphere, you can take a symmetric traceless tensor and write it as the sum of these two basis tensors, where the Q and the U here are the Stokes parameters. And they describe linear polarization, which is purely in the x direction would be Q. Linear polarization at 45 degrees would be U. And this guy would be minus Q. This guy would be minus U. So the Q and the U are like the X and Y components of a vector field. They're just the components in a particular basis. And if I rotate the coordinate system, then Q and U will generally rotate into each other. So the analog of the gradient curl decomposition for a traceless symmetric tensor works like this. So what I don't want to do, what wouldn't be very convenient, is to go to Fourier space by just Fourier transforming Q and U directly. What I want to do is consider the do is write down basis tensors which don't mix with each other under rotations. So this is the right way to do it. Expressions in brackets, in the case where the wave number L points in the x direction, then these basis tensors in brackets are the basis tensors that we wrote down here. But they're defined in such a way that they're lined up so lined up, so to speak, with the direction L hat. And they don't rotate into each other. If I start with a polarization field, which is all E, and I apply a rotation, then in the rotated coordinate system, it will continue to be all E. Or equivalently, if you do a little algebra, you can see that the Fourier modes of Q and U are related to these complex numbers E and B by this phi L dependent rotation, which is the same thing we had for a vector field with an extra factor of 2. So as in the vector case, this EB basis is just related to the QU basis by pointwise rotation at each value of L. By the way, in cosmology, there are several examples of traceless symmetric tensor fields that we observe on the sky. CMB polarization, but also the another example would be the weak lensing shear, which you know, if I look at a round object through a gravitational lens, it looks sheared into an ellipse. That shearing operator is described covariantly on the sphere by a traceless symmetric tensor, at least to lowest order in the so-called weak lensing limit. There aren't actually any examples of vector fields that we can directly observe on the sphere. So the GC decomposition is rarely actually used. It's just that the case of a vector field is a lot more intuitive with fewer indices, and also because everyone's familiar with the gradient curl decomposition. So I decided to start there, work through it, and then do the two-index case by analogy. So as in the two-index case, in the EB basis, if parity symmetry were not assumed, then there would be for each value of L, you would get this 2x2 real symmetric matrix describing the covariance, BB. And if parity invariance applies, as is the case in the standard cosmological model, the EB power spectrum is zero. Now, to describe the full CMB, we have a scalar field T, the temperature, and then a traceless symmetric field, the polarization, which you can think of as an E mode and a B mode. And the power spectra, which are non-zero in the standard model, are these. Parity invariance allows a TE correlation, but not a BB correlation. And that's just because B is like a pseudo-scalar-like quantity that picks up an extra minus sign under parity transformation. So it can't correlate with T, but E could. Um, in real space. Maybe decomposition could be written like this. There's some now second order differential operator. I apply to a scalar quantity. Plus another second order operator. Applied to some pseudo scalar. The EB decomposition is non-local in real space, just like the gradient curl decomposition of a vector field is a non-local operation in real space. In general, these scalar potentials, little e and little b, will involve integrals of the underlying tensor field P. If I want to invert these differential operators to get the potentials, I have to do integrals. So I can hear the cheering outside, and I think it's for this like faculty cooked lunch for everyone thing. Yeah. I have to arrive late, so I got assigned a shift as a dishwasher. I wanted to be a waiter because I thought that would be the most fun, but sadly, only dishwasher was available. Anyway. I want to just briefly write down and give a hand wave, write down the curved sky analog of the EB decomposition. And then give a hand-wavy proof of a really important theorem, which is that, so on the curved sky, one way of writing the EB decomposition is like this. So the polarization, which is now a traceless symmetric tensor on the sphere in the covariant GR sense, can be written as a sum of E mode harmonics and B mode harmonics with a different set of coefficients, ALME and ALMB for each. And just to write those down, so this object is similar to a spherical harmonic, but it's got two indices now. And it's just obtained from the usual spherical harmonic by applying this differential operator, except that now the to generalize to the sphere, I want to make that operator covariant by using covariant derivatives and the metric on the sphere. Apply that to the spherical harmonic. Just to make this formula like 100% kosher, there's a normalization here, which is just conventional that I'll include. And similarly for the B mode harmonics. I just write down the covariant version of the operator that I had before. Let me call these operators these differential operators, curly Eij and curly Bij. they operate on a scalar function and produce a or a pseudoscalar function in the case of the B operator, and produce a traceless symmetric tensor. So now the theorem that I want to prove. This is a super important theorem that doesn't have a name, but let me invent one and call it the no B mode theorem. It says that if the initial conditions of the universe are described by a set of scalar fields, as they are in the standard cosmological model, all of the initial conditions are determined by a single scalar quantity, the adiabatic curvature. But this hypothesis would be violated if you had gravity waves in the initial conditions or primordial magnetic fields, for example, or a pseudoscalar like an axion. Plus the assumption that linear perturbation theory is a good approximation. Then there are no B modes in the CMB. And this is a really important theorem because it means the B mode power spectrum of the CMB is very different from the temperature and the E mode power spectra. It's sensitive to different physics. You only get B modes if you violate one of these assumptions. So you could get B modes either by having gravity waves or some other more exotic non-scalar initial conditions, or because of the presence of second order effects, the largest of which by far is gravitational lensing. So B modes are also a very interesting probe of gravitational lensing in the late universe. And this theorem is a proof of the theorem, which I'll have to go through pretty fast, is another argument based on parity invariance, similar to the argument that says that you can't get an EB power spectrum. Oh, I guess another assumption here is parity invariance. Forgot to add that. So here's the argument. Since linear theory applies, I can just consider one K mode at a time. So it suffices to show that if the initial conditions of the universe only a single K mode was non-zero, that I got a polarization pattern consisting of only E modes. Since I could build up an arbitrary set of initial conditions by taking linear combinations of k's. So I can consider a single k. And by rotation invariance, I'll rotate to a coordinate system where the non-zero Fourier wave number points in the z direction. Now, without knowing anything about the physics, the initial conditions, because they're scalars, are invariant under azimuthal rotations around the z-axis, and also under parity reversing transformations that preserve the z-axis, like a reflection through the xz plane, say. That combination, so without knowing anything about the physics, it follows that the CMB polarization is invariant under the same symmetries. It's invariant under rotations around z hat plus, let's say, a reflection where x goes to negative x. And that combination of symmetries is sufficient to exclude a B mode. So just a mathematical statement given a traceless symmetric tensor on the sphere. If it's invariant under this set of symmetries, then it has to be an E mode. And the way the proof of that statement goes is that, analogous to the gradient curl decomposition for a vector field, I can start with an arbitrary polarization tensor and write it as the second order E operator applied to some scalar potential little e plus the second order B operator applied to some pseudoscalar little bit. Is that scalar? The definitions of the curly E and curly B operators are in these under braces. Then if this guy is invariant under rotations around Z, it follows that the potentials must be 2. So they are just functions of theta. And then if I apply the parity reflection, so this is just a function of theta. If I apply a parity reflection, it'll leave the sine of this guy. If I now take this equation and just observe it in a coordinate system where this parity reflection has been applied, then Pij won't change, little e won't change, but little b will get the minus sign. And so these two equations together imply that little b is 0. That's a sketch of the proof, although I glossed over some details, like showing that this decomposition into E and B is actually unique. That turns out to be true on the sphere, but I didn't prove it. Okay, so it's 12:31, so I guess I have to stop. I had some slides prepared where I was going to show pictures of the CMB power spectra and talk about the physics a little more and the search for B modes. But it's hard to cover everything in a 15-lecture class, or 13 lectures in this case. So it sort of happens to me every time I teach Psi that I feel like I really get going, and then the end of the class arrives, and I just have to stop talking. But that's how it goes. So I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks, everyone.